The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Okay, everyone, we're going to start up again. And this is the panel that we lovingly called Bailing Out on Transparency. If I can have everyone's attention at both ends, back ends of both sides of the room. We're hoping to stay as close to on schedule as we possibly can, because we have Senator Leahy on a relatively tight timetable later this morning, right after this panel, although we have a break right after this panel. But what I'm going to do is turn you over to someone who is pretty much the dean of the openness and government community in many respects, Gary Bass, who's the executive director and founder of OMB Watch, who's also a co-organizer of an organization called Coalition for Accountable Recovery, do I have that correct? CAR, whether we bail out Detroit or not. Those are the initials there. Wouldn't be anything in Washington without initials, right? And Gary is going to introduce everyone on the panel, mindful of the fact that the bios are out there, and then to lead the discussion on what I think can fairly be said to be one of the hottest, if not the hottest, topics in openness and government today. Thank you, Gary.
It's up.
Thanks, Dan. Topic here is bailing out transparency. I see lots of hands waving because we're trying to get the technology to work to have a PowerPoint show, and we'll see if it actually shows up. See if this works. Let me start by just talking about a couple key words that we've all been seeing in the news, whether it's subprime loans, exotic derivatives, the whole notion of public-private partnerships to buy out toxic assets. We've now seen language around rising unemployment. We've seen a continual rise in foreclosures that doesn't seem to ever end. And, of course, in our communities, crumbling infrastructure. All of those are symbols of the economic and financial crisis that that this country has faced and is facing. Some have likened it to being as bad as the Great Depression. All would agree that trillions of dollars of wealth have evaporated. Government has responded with various kinds of commitments to address this recovery. We're talking at least in the neighborhood of $8 trillion have been committed. We're familiar with the $700 billion of the Troubled Assets Relief Program, TARP. We're also familiar with the nearly $800 billion Recovery Act that just came out. And there may be more still coming. President Obama has promised unprecedented transparency and accountability, particularly as it relates to the Recovery Act. He's already established recovery.gov. He has also promised enormous oversight. And he has said on bailout, we need much greater oversight and transparency. Just yesterday on the bailout side of things, we all saw in the newspaper today that AIG, now a company that is roughly 80% owned by the government, released in an unprecedented fashion the kinds of use of the bailout dollars which the government pressured them to put out. And that data that was put out, that information, has stirred up a hornet's nest, if not just simply because of how the millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars, were being used for bonuses and retention pay, then because the billions of dollars that went to companies that in turn were getting other bailout dollars. Nonetheless, I think that the American public wants and demands that kind of transparency. Each one of the panelists that I'm going to introduce have pointed out weaknesses in that bailout transparency. Just last week, the person on this side of me, Greg LeRoy, told ABC News, and I'll quote, when he was talking about the Recovery Act, the fact that the recovery.gov is getting such traffic tells us people want to watch where their money is going. But right now, the system doesn't give the details it needs. Significant portions of the Recovery Act are being distributed by states and localities, and as we all know, as money goes further and further from Washington, it gets harder and harder for the transparency to occur. In light of that, and in light of the fact that Sunshine Week, a poll was released where the public views, 73% of the public views the federal government as secretive, 44% view state government as secretive, the challenge in this panel is to talk about, can we get true and meaningful transparency and accountability with all these recovery issues? We're going to start the panel with the order. I'll introduce them. I'm not going to go into great detail because you have in your packet the bios of each of the four speakers. Let me just present the order. Greg LeRoy, who in addition to being the director of Good Jobs First, is the co-chair with me of the coalition Dan just mentioned, the Coalition for an Accountable Recovery, CAR. On the other side, we'll go to Ryan Alexander. Ryan, in addition, or in being the head of Taxpayers for Common Sense, has been relied on by the news media almost regularly for commentary on how bailout has been going and the work of her organization in providing profiles on the banks that are receiving money have been used by virtually all of us at one time or another. We'll then go to Danielle Bryan, who is one of the premier players in running the Project on Government Oversight in monitoring oversight of both the economic and the financial activities. Danielle is on the steering committee of the coalition I mentioned, CAR. In addition, along with Ryan and John, are all part, along with OMB Watch, of a bailout watch, a new project. And then batting cleanup will be John Irons from the Economic Policy Institute, who is Director of Research and Policy. John, when all of us care so much about transparency, we're all kind of wonks on the policy. We're lawyers, we're policy analysts. John is an economist, and John is going to tell us what kind of information we really need or what kind of analysis we need to know whether taxpayers are getting the right kind of deal. With that, each of the panelists are going to speak for about 8 minutes, 8 to 10. That leaves roughly about 10 at the end for a question and answer with the audience. Greg, why don't you pick up and start along.
Thanks, and good morning, everyone. As you see from the handout I gave everybody, Good Jobs First works mostly at the state and local level on transparency regarding economic development tax breaks, something some people call corporate welfare. And we've always said that sunshine is the best antiseptic, that when you have the ability to see where the money's going, when costs and benefits are visible, only good things happen in terms of reforming economic development incentive programs. A lot of the money spent at state and local level really akin to all the pipelines that are now getting funded by the Recovery Act. And as you can see, there's a study on there called the State of State Disclosure, where we actually rated all 50 states' websites disclosing their economic development incentives as well as their procurement activity. So President Obama says he wants the Recovery Act to be the most transparent spending ever, and he builds this website, recovery.gov. I think it's easy to see that he has at least two motives here. One, he wants to avoid the black eye that TARP has. He doesn't want the Recovery Act to be viewed the same way, and TARP is notoriously opaque, and that goes a long way to explaining why the public dislikes it so much. But it's also fair to say that President Obama is a genuine transparency buff. He co-sponsored with Tom Colburn of Oklahoma the Federal Funding Accountability and Transparency Act of 2006, and our modest moderator, Gary Bass, worked with them in drafting that legislation. It created a website called usaspending.gov, which is really the state of the art that is now being leapfrogged, if you will, by recovery.gov. So when we launched this coalition in early February, about 30 different organizations signed on to it. It's a very diverse set of groups that really reflects lots of different interests in the way the Recovery Act money is getting spent. So you've got groups concerned about public education, you have grassroots community organizing groups, you have good government groups like Common Cause, Consumers Union, the Economic Policy Institute, campaign finance reform organizations, the groups represented here on the panel, smart growth groups like Smart Growth America and the Transportation Equity Network, the Sunlight Foundation, US PIRG, lots of different groups like that. And at a different level, now there's also a whole new layer of organizing around the Recovery Act at the state level, so that state and local affiliates of many of the groups I just mentioned, as well as other networks that are not affiliated yet with CAR, are forming state-based coalitions to watch the Recovery Act money. We say our mantra is we want millions of eyeballs watching the money. And if it's true that recovery.gov got $150 million hits in its first 2.5 weeks up, millions of eyeballs are reporting for duty, and we want to make sure they're satisfied. The problem is right now they'll be frustrated if they're trying to see outcomes right now, because the problem is that the current guidance coming from OMB allows money to basically disappear once it changes hands twice. So if it were to go from the, say, commerce agency, or from the federal government to a state commerce agency and then to a program there, then the money would disappear. The recovery, there would be no further reporting below that level. If it were to go to a state agency and then a contractor, then the Recovery Act transparency would end. You wouldn't see anything at the subcontractor level, and we know that the subcontractors really tend to employ the greatest number of people. So we filed 2 weeks ago a detailed memo laying out our preferred architecture for recovery.gov, and at its heart we say we want every ultimate organizational end user, that is an entity, whether it's a public agency or a private contractor, employing people doing things with Recovery Act money funded by the Recovery Act, to be reporting monthly on their outcomes. And we don't want the states or cities involved in this. We want it all to go to one central federal portal where each ultimate organizational end user of the money would report monthly on their both their programmatic outcomes, you know, how many school buildings did you modernize, how many homes did you weatherize, how many green job trainees did you train, et cetera, but also the number of hours of work created, the number of people employed, the quality of the jobs, the health care each month. It's really, I use the analogy of a frequent flyer profile, that is, once a contractor or an agency had entered itself and sort of set itself up in its project files, then they would be able to just go to the portal, update their data in their frequent flyer profile, if you will, in their Recovery Act file, their project file. And then we say that raw data that's reported by every ultimate end user should then be completely visible to everybody with a PC. And the information would be tagged with project numbers and corporate identifiers and geographic identifiers so that anybody could sort the data by project, by city, by employer, by state, by any measure they wanted to use to look and see what the money's doing in their community or in their industry or in their company. We also suggest that a lot of the data that would be appropriate for that is already collected by companies. It's already used, for instance, to file their unemployment insurance premiums. It's already used to file what's called the EEO-1 discrimination report for the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. It's already filed when companies are selected to participate in Bureau of Labor Statistics surveys. We're not talking about new research here. It's really data that companies provide routinely. Finally, we say that this is both good policy and necessary politics. Anytime that somebody spends as much money as this in such a short period of time, it's a recipe for mischief. There's some very large checks getting written to some public officials who couldn't be described as good government types. And without millions of eyeballs watching what these people are doing with the money, there really is a risk that the Recovery Act will come to be viewed or confused with TARP by the public. Some people don't distinguish them in their minds anyway already. So we say that the sunshine really is the best antiseptic. The best way to make sure that the Recovery Act works, that it's kept clean, that it's effective, that it's fair, is that everybody can see what's going on. And more broadly, this really hinges on the public's view of government's proper role in the economy. If it's perceived as a failure because people can't even see what's going on with their money, there's a real risk that people will fall back on their negative cognitive frames about government's role in the economy, and we think that would be a tragedy. Thanks. Go to the next panelist.
Ryan, do you want to? Ryan's got part of a voice.
I've got part of a voice, and I'm going to sit down. Is the mic working okay? I apologize for the this crappy voice I have right now. I'm going to talk a little bit about the bailout from the fall and the transparency, what we have and what we don't have from the bill they passed to bail out the financial industries, and also to talk a little bit about the Federal Reserve and what we do and don't know about what they do. When they passed the, and I'm completely forgetting the actual name of the bailout bill, Economic Stabilization and Recovery Act, I think. They included a number of different structures for oversight. Danielle's going to talk a little bit about that. But, they also designed, one thing I just want to kind of highlight is kind of where we see transparency problems in the bailout, they're often real indications of underlying problems of reasoning and of, how they designed the entire bill. So they designed the bill around several different programs. There was TARP, which we all heard a ton about, which was we're going to go out and buy troubled assets, and that's going to take care of everything. There's capital purchase program, which initially Treasury was like, we're not so interested in capital purchase. We're not going to just put cash into these institutions. The systemically failing institutions, i.e. the special AIG program, which we're not going to call the special AIG program, and term asset limit, the TALF program, which is starting to get a little more attention. I can't remember exactly what it stands for anymore. But initially, Treasury was planning on spending most of this money through TARP, and it became very quickly apparent that there were real problems with that, not least of which is that there was no way for the government to know more than the selling institutions about these bad assets. So the valuation questions were really complex. Having, what they could reveal to the public, depended on what they knew, and they weren't really figuring things out about exactly how much the value of these assets were and where they would, how they could best deploy taxpayer dollars. They ended up putting most of the money that's gone out the door through the capital purchase program, which is essentially investments of cash into what are, deemed healthy banks, including Citibank is allegedly a healthy bank, with the idea that this was going to increase the credit markets, it was going to increase the flow of credit. That said, one thing that our methods at taxpayers are in part to just kind of do transparency to the government. We advocate for it, but we also just kind of bring it. We are best known for, in many ways, our databases of earmarks, which we've done for 5 years, and until the last year, Congress never provided any information and said they could never do it, and we just went through members of Congress's websites and looked at their press releases and combed through the bills and created databases. It was a pain, but it was, doable. It was not that hard. So we have been going to Treasury. Treasury's putting up more information through this TARP program and the capital purchase program than they have customly done in the past several years. If you went to the Treasury website, you wouldn't really find that much information out. That said, because they've spent all this money through the capital purchase program, the valuable, whether or not that information is really valuable, is dependent on how much you can find out about the banks. What we've been doing is we've been doing profiles on all the banks that are receiving funds through this program. There have been 495 banks that have received money through the capital purchase program so far. We are doing profiles of everyone. We've done about half. Again, I got a small staff. The government could do this, but they're not. Where we put up all of their SEC filings, their political contribution filings, the government's contract data, and data about the banks themselves. But very little information, good information, is available about some of these banks. As we saw in the headlines this morning, AIG, just now released what they're doing with their money, and only under great, great pressure. The other banks, they weren't asked to tell us what they were doing with the money. They weren't asked to report on what their lending rates were. Interestingly, we have had a handful of banks call us because they feel like they've been unfairly maligned in the press. And they swear that they really are lending the money. But since they weren't required to report that publicly, we can't find that. But that was a failure in design of the entire program as opposed to just design in transparency. The absence of transparency really shed light on what were the problems with the program. Go to our website at taxpayer.net and look at if you go bank biographies, you can get to the trove of bank bios that we put together, and we are updating that pretty frequently, if not daily. The other thing I want to talk just a little bit about is the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve is is a black hole. There's very little information about what the Federal Reserve does that's available to the public. One thing that in the fall, I remember just reading the paper and going through things, in one day the Federal Reserve put out $800 billion, more than the entire bailout program. It wasn't a headline, wasn't the front page of the news of the business section. Through the Federal Reserve lending facilities, where they do, you know, overnight transfers, commercial paper, where they provide funds to participating institutions to basically maintain the flow of credit, maintain the flow of the financial system, they don't have to report very much of this to the public at all. They report aggregate data. We can identify what banks may be eligible to receive money under certain programs, and then how much money has gone out through those programs. But that's about the level of detail that we have available. So for the trillions now of dollars that have gone out through the Federal Reserve, we know very little. Another organization that all of us work with, the Center for Economic Policy Research, put out a paper last week on one of the federal lending facility programs where there's a limited number of institutions that are eligible. So it was a little easier to do some analysis about how much money those institutions might be getting. But again, I think it points out, you know, these are the questions that you get from transparency are not just what information can I get, what information can't I get. It's why are they making these decisions? You know, what's behind these underlying decisions? And at every step of the way, the failure in transparency in the bailout has indicated a failure in program design, I think. One final thing that just to illustrate that before I hand it over to Danielle is we got, you know, we had one of those couple days of crazy amount of press attention in the fall because we found just on the Treasury website the application that you had to fill out to participate in the capital purchase program. It's 2 pages, and the first page is contact information. Literally, you know, this is, if you think about applying for student loans or applying for a mortgage, it's harder than it is to fill out the capital purchase program application. And when we put that up on our website with a little blurb, that, you know, we had thousands of people come and get it, you know, tons of news media talk to us. You know, in part it was an easy, cheap shot of like, oh, you're getting billions of dollars and you fill out a 2-page application that's not as hard as your student loan applications. But at the same time, it points out the fact that, yes, Treasury put it up, but, you know, it took, you know, nerdy watchdogs combing through the website to find it and say, hey, this is kind of worth noting, as opposed to Treasury saying, straightforwardly, this is how the process is going to work. This is what we're going to demand of banks. These are your dollars, and we want you to know what we're demanding of banks before we give them our money. That the independent watchdog groups, of course, we are going to push the agencies to do a better job, but the level where we've had to do that in this instance is kind of striking. That, you know, little watchdogs are saying, by the way, your application is pathetic, is sad. You know, this is a huge amount of money, and it's not just that they aren't giving us enough information. They're not asking enough information. They're not tracking enough information. You know, it's going to be hard to value whether or not we're getting a good deal for taxpayer dollars, because it's hard to know whether or not Treasury is getting the right information to know that. So I'm going to rest my voice. And
is it comfortable to let us stay sitting here? Everyone can see, I think.
Just get the mic closer.
Get the mic closer. All right. That was amazing, given I know how your voice is stressed right now. So I'm going to talk first half about bailout, second half about, are we calling it stimulus or recovery? Recovery. So when the bailout was announced by Secretary Paulson, it was actually serendipitously at a time where, again, Gary's OMB Watch had gathered all those people who care about transparency to a conference, and so the timing was fantastic. And it was actually the Heritage Foundation that first noted while we were all there, and that's one of the great things about this effort of transparency. It is truly, as described, transpartisan. So we had people from the left, the right, and neither, all together. And Heritage said, hey, did you look at what Paulson just put out? Because this bailout actually has a provision that says none of the provisions in this language will be subject to review, either administrative or otherwise. And so a gaggle of transparency geeks are all like, what? How can we possibly accept that this will be the standard of transparency or consideration where nobody is allowed to review it? So within, I think, was it 24 hours? 77 organizations, which those of you who work organizationally, that is really hard to get 77 organizations to agree on a letter that demanded more transparency on the bailout. And this was December 8th that this letter was released. And I firmly believe that it was because of the breadth and depth of the organizations involved in this that then lit up the blogosphere. The Congress was immediately put on notice that this is completely not okay, that a number of things made what could have been even worse. Let's remember how bad bailout is, as Ryan described. It could have been much worse. It was going to be much worse if it weren't, I think, for the public interest community. So as a result, the Congress added some provisions. One is that they created what's called the SIGTARP, the Special Inspector General for the TARP. And they also created a congressional oversight panel that was appointees, outside people appointed by the Congress. Many of you have probably seen Elizabeth Warren, who's the chair, who is doing is just a fantastic job in being sort of a public advocate and speaking often on the media and otherwise about what they're seeing, as well as demanding that the legislation also demanded more GAO access to the information so that the GAO could be regularly reporting to the Congress what they were seeing in the TARP. So good, but still not great. So some of the problems with those provisions, one thing is with the Special Inspector General, it took months after they created this provision to actually appoint and confirm the guy. And here we are in March, and he is still barely staffed at all. And legislation had been introduced but not passed. It was going to give him emergency hiring authority, but it didn't pass. So he has to go, he is struggling through the federal hiring process in order to hire. And so even by the point of the time that he was confirmed, half the money was already out the door. And, you know, now we know it's like vastly more out the door, and the guy's, you know, struggling to stay above water. The Congressional Oversight Panel, I can't say enough about that model. I think it's something that we should remember as future issues arise, as they will, that that is a model that we should think about, because the fact that it's congressionally appointed, as I'll point out, is contrary to what's happened with the recovery package, is a good balance. So you have the IG, who is a presidential appointment, and the congressional appointees of the panel conducting oversight. So you have those provisions. However, the public access, as Ryan has very clearly pointed out, is totally unacceptable to this information. I actually have talked to people both on the panel and the SIGTARP. They are not as of yet, at least the SIGTARP is not as of yet concerned that he's not getting the information that he's demanding, but we're not getting it at all in the public eye. And the absence of access to information, and AIG is, of course, the best place to look at this, fuels suspicions. Like, if we don't know where AIG's money went, why are they hiding that? And why is that not becoming transparent? Secretary Geithner and Chairman Bernanke, I don't believe, really get how important transparency is to public confidence. The theory behind all of this is creating confidence in the economy. The lack of transparency, I firmly believe, was undermining the confidence. It was counterproductive. So what we saw was terrific bipartisan congressional oversight, and that's something I'm a huge advocate for, so I want to give them shout-outs, that they actually were doing their job in the Congress. You had Congressman Castle, Congresswoman Maloney, Maria Cantwell, I want to mention that, and also Congressman Garrett, a Republican of New Jersey, really pushing on both Geithner and Bernanke, saying, where did this money go? We want to know why AIG was so important to you. And one of the concerns Pogo had was there were 11 alumni of Goldman Sachs who were involved in the decision to bail out AIG. And it, as it turned out, we now know today, as we suspected, they were very happy to get that money, Goldman Sachs, because they were the number two biggest recipient of the AIG funds. The argument that Geithner and Bernanke were making was we can't force AIG to disclose who their counterparties were because that will create a lack of confidence in the counterparties and they will then go under. So now let's see what happens. I'm really dying to see if everyone goes under now that it's transparent. I don't believe it will, and I don't want them to be allowed to use that as an excuse to hold information from the government anymore. The Maria Cantwell, I just cannot believe, there's actually a YouTube clip of this interaction with Secretary Geithner. It was appalling. She was saying, I want to know where the money, why we bail out AIG and where the money went. And his answer was repeatedly, that was a decision made by your government. That's just not good enough. You know, we have a right to know. This is a lot of money. And it was extraordinary to me. And I think she really did a great job. She kept coming back at it. And I really believe the reason it came out today is because the Congress just would not let them get away with it. So we now have part two of what we think is really of concern and potentially guided by conflicts of interest, which is the Fed's contractors on the bailout. We'd put out a letter last week demanding to know who the counterparties on AIG was because of this Goldman Sachs conflict of interest. We're really worried about the contractors that the Fed has contracted with to evaluate the $118 billion in assets that the Fed has underwritten. And the reason we're concerned is those companies, there's four companies, PIMCO, BlackRock, Goldman Sachs, they're there again, and Wellington Management. Those companies are not only hired by the Fed to evaluate those assets, but they are also themselves investing in those same types of mortgage-backed securities for their clients. So they have a very clear professional conflict in how they value those assets. And we're not getting anything from the Fed that helps us have any confidence that they're really doing anything about this obvious self-interest on the part of those contractors. So just so you know, POGA is going to be putting a letter out in a week that's really honing in on this as the next conflict that we as the public deserve to know. Why were these companies hired? Are you aware of their conflict? And this matters to us. It matters to the integrity of the whole process. Shifting now to recovery, because we need to make sure we're not confusing the two. They're very different. So on the recovery, the oversight mechanisms that were created through that legislation, one was hilariously the RAT board is what it's called, the Recovery Accountability and Transparency Board. It is 10 IGs will be on this board. Those 10 IGs actually of the agencies that are receiving the stimulus funds or most of the stimulus funds, those IGs themselves, IGs being inspectors general, I know everyone here is a wonk, but you may not be that much of a wonk. Those IGs themselves got additional funds to conduct oversight. They will then be on a board where they'll be collaborating to oversee it. That is the board that is actually going to be running recovery.gov that Greg was talking about. And the other provision in the recovery that was an important oversight function is that there were whistleblower protections provided to state and local and contractor employees who were watching the stimulus funds. I have to mention that the Congress, in its infinite stupidity, continues not to provide federal employees the same protections, but there we go. Those are important. It's important also to know that there was a time where that RAT board was actually going to be filled with deputy secretaries of agencies rather than IGs, and we just thought that was a terrible idea. That is actually similar to a board that exists that I didn't even mention in the bailout because I don't see those as oversight functions where the heads of agencies, deputy secretaries really actually run their agencies, and the idea that they're conducting oversight of themselves is just silly. So. Fortunately, that provision was struck, and they are at least inspectors generals who are on that board. There's so much money at stake with the recovery, though. IGs are never going to be able to cover adequately, no matter how good they are, all the potential misconduct or waste or abuse in the system. That is why, as Greg was describing, we need the boots on the ground citizens with their millions of eyes watching for us so that when people say that a bridge is being built somewhere, the people who live there can actually say if it's being built and who's doing the work. So when you're talking about this much money, that's where it becomes so essential to have public access to information so that they can be both seeing what the government is claiming is happening, but also being able to report back what actually, in fact, is happening from the ground. So that, to us, is enormously important. There's also, with the stimulus, a final panel that I referenced slightly before, which is a presidentially appointed panel to oversee the RAT board. And this sort of, I'm not thrilled with the fact that they're both presidentially appointed panels. It would have been nice to have that balance of power for a congressional, but we'll see how that happens. As far as I know, no one's been appointed to that panel yet. The last thing I just was going to mention was FOIA. FOIA, really, all of us have not slept in a while, because what's happening now is so fast, and money is coming out so, fire hose quantities, that FOIA is such a lengthy process. By the time we get anything back, I mean, we are putting FOIAs in, and it will be useful after the fact to find out. But that is why recovery.gov needs to be really good, so that we don't have to wait for that agonizingly long process to have the information we need to make sure the money is spent well.
Great. Thanks. John Irons.
Thanks, Gary. First, let me say, as Gary mentioned before, that I'm an economist. I'm not a lawyer nor a secrecy expert per se. Everything I know about FOIA law comes from Gary, working at OMB Watch with him for a year. So if I get anything wrong on this, it's Gary's fault.
And economist jokes are welcomed.
Economist jokes are notoriously not very funny, either about economists or by economists. Having said that, I'm going to have a couple of economist jokes in here, so I fully expect not much laughter. The second thing I want to say is that we're covering about, $8 trillion worth of outlays, either through the recovery package or through the Federal Reserve or the TARP program, which gives me about $125 billion per second for the next 8 minutes. So I'm only going to really scratch the surface of the issues here. So what I'm set to address today was whether or not or how we are to determine whether taxpayers are getting good value for their money or not. What information do we need? How do we analyze it, et cetera? In the case of the Treasury Department bailout, what we need to know are a set of things, getting the full details of the terms of the transactions, asset purchases, loan guarantees, stock purchases, et cetera, exactly what terms are attached. And in the case of the Recovery and Reinvestment Act, that means getting data on the number and the kinds of jobs created, as Greg talked about. But let me tackle the Treasury Department first. So I want to acknowledge that the Treasury Department has done a fairly good job, not a great job, but a good job, of putting a significant amount of bailout data on their website. So, for example, you can go online today, and you can find the term sheets, the standard term sheets, or contract terms for the capital asset program, the capital purchase program, the target investment program, the systemically significant failing institution program, the automotive industry finance program, and the consumer and bailout lending initiative, as well as the making home affordable program. Just a couple of the things that Treasury Department does here. So get out your pencils. So given we have all these programs, how do you value what the taxpayer money has gone to buy? Okay, so here's what you do. It's very simple. You find the total support given to the 450 so banks or financial institutions under each program. You apply the general term sheet condition or the specific contract terms, including share volume, dividend rates, warrant grants, loan guarantees, et cetera. You then value each of these different classes of assets given their conversion prices, maturity, redemption rules, et cetera. You value the underlying price and current and projected volatility of the primary assets or stocks. You then run these assets through a valuation model. I like Black-Scholes, but you could also compare these to currently existed and trading assets. But before you do all that, very important, you have to get your master's degree or a PhD in finance. I think the Kogod School is still accepting applications. Simple, right? You can actually do this. You could actually get out there and get all this data and try to run these numbers yourself. Or you could do what the Congressional Oversight Panel did, was you hire a valuation company to do this for you. They have three very well-renowned economists on their oversight board who then commissioned a study from a valuation firm to to come up with this analysis. Now, they did this for the 10 largest recipients, so 10 down, 440 left to go. It was only a 670-page report that they produced in order to do this. Bottom line was they found that the Treasury Department had overpaid for the assets. So there was an embodied subsidy in the transaction that the Treasury Department has actually done. So where does this leave us? I think, you know, I want to make a bigger point here, which is it's not just enough to throw out the raw data on contracts. Now, I think Gary's been a leader in really making the case that in order for this data to be useful, in order for data in general to be useful, it has to be more than just scanned in PDF files of contracts or other kinds of data, not just in this area, but in lots of other areas. The data has to be adequately organized, has to be presented in machine-readable format in order to be of use to the public. Now, I want to take that a step farther. It's not just organizing the data, but there's a level of analysis that has to be done to the data before it becomes of much use to the general public. So I think, you know, I want to argue that we need what I might call analytic transparency. So not just data transparency, but transparency on how you would analyze data, how the government is analyzing the data internally. So we need more than the raw data, in this case terms and contracts. We need more than the data presented in an organized, searchable, computable, readable formats. We also need information on how the government analyzes their actions and the results of those actions. In the case of the Treasury TARP program, that means we need to know how the Treasury is valuing these assets, both their methodology as well as their final results. Not just because of the complexity of these issues. Now, these are complex issues, but that's not the only reason. But we also need to know if they intended, for example, to overpay for these assets. Right? There is a difference between buying some assets, making an investment, and then having it not pan out, or making an investment which you know from the get-go is not going to pan out. What did the Treasury know? Right? What were they thinking when they wrote these contracts, set the terms? Were they intending there to be a subsidy, or is it just turned out to be the case that they made a fairly bad investment from day one? The second reason why this is important is because it's actually, I think, embedded in the law. When you look at the actual legislation that authorized the Treasury to do these actions, there are elements of it which I think necessitate some valuation by the Treasury. Now, being at a law school, I'm going to feel compelled to quote law on this. Section 113C says, the Secretary shall pursue additional measures to ensure that prices paid for assets are reasonable and reflect the underlying value of the asset. So law requires that the purchase price reflect something in terms of the value. Did Treasury actually do some of these calculations themselves? If so, what did they show? So we need this kind of, again, analytic transparency to figure that out. A second example on warrants. Warrants are, just think of them as stock options. It's the ability to exercise and purchase a stock at a given price. That portion of legislation says the terms and conditions shall be designed to provide for reasonable participation by the Secretary for the benefit of the taxpayers in equity appreciation in the case of a warrant or other equity security or reasonable interest rate premium in the case of a debt instrument. Of course, these are vague. What is a reasonable premium? Who knows? But what did the Treasury know? How much were they thinking when they bought these assets was a reasonable premium? So again, we need the analytic transparency to really get a handle on these things. So let me switch gears briefly in my remaining time to talk about the Recovery Act. There's a similar concern when it comes to the outlay of funds for infrastructure spending, aid to states, and the other provisions of the Recovery Act. The goal of the Recovery Act, remember, is to create jobs. And so as Greg talked about, we need to get some information on the number and the kinds of jobs that are created. But again, this dictates or necessitates some kind of analytic transparency. For example, it is required that the primary recipient of recovery funds is tasked with coming up with a job estimate. Now, what are they going to do? You know, you can imagine Ohio receives a share of money to spend on roads and bridges. Will the Ohio government then come back to the federal government in terms of recovery.gov and say, 10,000 jobs? There you go. You know, does that satisfy the legislation? It may, as currently written. Now, OMB has some guidance about what you need to report, and it might be the case that the guidance might require a little bit more information, but who knows. So what we need, again, is some, again, analytic transparency so that we can figure out what number are they reporting, how do they come up with that estimate, is this a seat-of-the-pants estimate? Is this something that they derived from contractors and subcontractors and sub-subcontractors who were then required to report their payroll data on the number and kinds of jobs? Or was this something else? Some of these estimates will have to be estimates. There are direct jobs created, people with shovels building roads and bridges. Some of these numbers will be supplier jobs. So when you repurchase asphalt, that creates jobs down the line. Those are harder to really get a handle on. Some of these jobs will be what we call, what economists call respending jobs. So a construction worker has more money in his or her pocket. They go to McDonald's. They buy a Big Mac, and that creates jobs on that front. So some of the job creation numbers will have to be, by their very nature, estimates. How are those estimates done? This is important because when we have so much different money going to so many different places, we have to have some consistency across states, across regions, across cities, across contractors. Otherwise, what you're going to get is going to be a mishmash of stuff, and we won't know how to evaluate it. So again, you know, in order to have the most effective transparency data, we do have to have some level of methodological consistency and some measure of analytic transparency on that front. So again, in both cases, a lack of what I call, again, analytic transparency allows for sloppy analytics at the very least, but it also opens the door for decision-making that is sloppy, that doesn't follow the letter or the intent of the law, or that violates other principles of good government. So again, when we talk about transparency, I would urge everyone to think about this in a more expansive way than just getting the raw data.
Clearly, four experts, and really quite knowledgeable. We open up the floor for conversation, questions, comments, and then allow the panel to react. And while people are coming up, oh, we have someone already coming up. Go ahead. Feel free. I was going to give my list of questions, but go ahead. And say who you are.
Thank you. I'm Ethan Marin. I'm a 3L here at Washington College of Law. And I just want to thank the panel first for giving a really excellent discussion of these issues. Regarding the Federal Reserve System, the black hole of this whole process, I was just wondering if you could discuss a little bit that issue specifically. I was shocked at how the Federal Reserve Board of Governors is now claiming that the Federal Reserve banks in their Bloomberg litigation are not federal agencies, when there's already case law out there saying that they are agencies under the Administrative Procedure Act, which FOIA uses that definition. And in fact, the Southern District of New York has previously handled a FOIA case against the New York Reserve Bank, which is what is currently involved in Bloomberg. So I was just shocked when this came out. I was hoping you could maybe tell me, what are they thinking? Because I have no idea.
I'm going to ask Ryan Alexander to respond. And then just for fun, John Irons used to work at the Fed, so I'd like him to throw in his two cents too.
I mean, you know, I think the short answer on what are they thinking is, hey, you got to try. I mean, there's the case law in this is clear that nothing stops people. Frequently, extraordinary circumstances, reverse case law. I hope and don't think they'll be successful in that, but I really don't think there's much more there than, hey, you got to try. But it absolutely reinforces this issue of the lack of transparency. You know, we should fear lack of transparency because it may well be just shielding these kind of cloudy decisions.
Actually, one thing I would just mention is, and I don't remember where the exchange took place on the Hill, but Chairman Bernanke really took offense when people were pushing him and sort of suggesting that they had questions about the integrity of the decisions that the Fed was making. And he was saying, whoa, how can you be
so
questioning
good.
My integrity? Trust me. And he's like, well, you know, it's not going to work. You have to be transparent for people not to be questioning the integrity of these decisions.
Let me first say that my very high-profile, powerful position at the Federal Reserve was research assistant for 2 years right out of college. So, but I'm not going to defend the Fed in transparency, but let me explain what their logic is. And this is not a legal case. This is their economic thinking, just to put some context on it. One of the traditional Federal Reserve roles is lender of last resort. So they play the role of you can't get money from any place else, go to the Fed. And so what they have in the back of their mind is, people who come to us, banks who come to us, are in the situation where they're in trouble. And they can't get money through other banks, through someplace else, and so they're, you know, teetering on the edge. And so they come at this from the perspective of, if we were to tell everyone who came to us asking for a handout or just a plain ordinary loan, that's going to send a signal to the market, which is going to cause a cash run on that bank, either with individual investors or with institutional investors, and that will make the bank collapse. So their default is, if we give people this information, that will do two things. One is, in the short run, it will cause banks to collapse when they come to us, and that can't be a good solution. The second thing is that will stop banks from coming to us, and that will cause banks to have to go to one another, not to the Federal Reserve, and get higher interest rates and threaten their stability down the road. So their default position is, oh my God, if we have to tell people what we're doing, it's going to destabilize the whole system and cause banks to go under. I think the current situation we're in is that everyone's getting help, either from the Treasury or from the Federal Reserve. And so at this point in time, there's no real signal that's being sent to the market if you're going and getting bailout money. Everyone's kind of getting it.
In fairness to Treasury and in this entire process, I think that history of the Fed is the underpinning of the kind of starting point of lack of transparency of, we have to maintain confidence in the system, and we believe that telling you that it's going to be okay is the way to do that. And they have overwhelming evidence to the contrary right now that just telling us it's going to be okay is not, you know, we're not all being like, you know what, I am going to get that renovation loan. You know, it's not working that way. So starting from this position of secrecy is in the benefit of the public is just a very different place to be starting for an agent, you know, for a set of agencies that suddenly control so much of the world economy.
And just before you ask your question, I will say that openness depends on the seat you're in. I was in a meeting with a hedge fund manager who said, the Fed is such an open agency. It's wonderful. At which point everyone sort of went, whoa.
Hi, Gary. Max Kakis from Federal News Radio. Two things I just wanted to point out very quickly. Last week, Congressman Van Hollen reintroduced the whistleblower bill, which would hopefully absolve federal workers who reveal instances of fraud, waste, and abuse at their agencies. He's hopeful that this time will be the charm for that measure. Also, Congressman Kucinich held a really good hearing last week in the House Government Oversight Committee regarding XGML, which is the extensible business reporting markup language that's used by the SEC for reporting. They have a pilot program out now for some smaller corporations to file their 10-Ks and forms like that. And the thing he looked at here was using XGML as a way to track TARP spending and money as a way to for linking into recovery.gov for that purpose. And I'd be interested in John Irons' thoughts about that.
I can
do the whistleblower.
Yes,
side.
Oh, thanks, Max, for pointing out right on the whistleblower front. The House has consistently been terrific on this, and that was the one bipartisan amendment to the stimulus package that was no problem in the House. The Senate is this constant problem when it comes to the whistleblowers.
Now, Gary knows much more about the architecture here, I think, if you want to address that question.
I think I didn't go to the hearing, but I think the notion of using open standards are essential for any kind of recovery broadly, whether it's TARP or whether it's recovery.gov data. Without having some kind of open standard for the reporting to occur, most of us who want to take that data and use it are going to be baffled. And so whether it's XBRL or another standard that applies to business kind of and financial data, it's going to be essential, and it has to happen quickly. We'll probably need the Office of Management and Budget to put out that kind of guidance, not only to the agencies, but then the agencies on down the line to whoever receives the dollars so that the reporting is done in some kind of standardized or unified, uniform manner.
Thank you.
Thanks, Max.
Dan Scholar, National Academy of Public Administration. Mr. Irons has laid out in a troubling way, the dimensions and the need for analytic transparency. But I think my question has to go to beyond him, because it is, how in the heck do we organize, try to create consistency, and develop means of educating the public and then advising the public about analytic transparency?
We agree there's going to be analytic transparency challenges. So, for instance, if OMB were to accept our advice and create the architecture that I explained, where every ultimate end user reports every month into one unified portal system, that could still be very overwhelming to users, right, because you're just sitting on giant amounts of raw data, even if you can slice and dice it by zip code and contractor and community and things like that. So I think there's some real open questions about what else OMB and the respective federal agencies to which this money is flowing do to take that raw data and make it user-friendly and make it aggregate in ways that's not spinning and exaggerating and not using, you know, BS estimating methods. Using maybe BEA, you know, RIMS 2, Bureau of Economic Analysis estimating methods, or something that's a lot more credible, that's a real challenge. We agree.
Does that panel want to respond?
I mean, I think that it's, you know, it is worth noting that this is hard. You know, this isn't just going to be, I mean, on the one hand, there are problems of will that we're trying to overcome with advocacy, but there are, you know, we may not come to the solution all in one fell swoop. That said, I think, you know, it's always important to kind of look at this in context. This is a massive amount of complex information that people need to understand. But, you know, eBay looks at all of its transaction detail and knows, you know, well, gosh, the people who subscribe to the New Yorker and get their hair colored twice a year buy more than the people who, you know, subscribe to New York Review of Books and never get their hair cut. You know, companies have figured out ways to parse data in ways that is that are useful, that are easy, that they can use. The ability to do different types of analytical transparency and broad data slicing and dicing, it is available on the commercial market, and we should, you know, it's just a matter of making sure that we push people to do it and give the feedback of what's useful and what's not.
And Dan, I just want to add in, I think that what we're talking about today, whether it's the Recovery Act, whether it's TARP, we're talking about the building blocks for doing this right in the future. And so this is the time where we've got to figure out how to do it. I also think, Max, your question about the standards relates to this, to the ability of citizen empowerment, because if we get the standards right, it then means that the data streams can go out and that many of us, whether it's at NAPA, whether it's Economic Policy Institute, whether it's a community group, can build on those analytic tools that then make it more empowering for others to get access to the data in ways that make sense. That's where the doors open up, and that's what this new model of Web 2.0 really represents.
I'll just lay out one other layer of self-interest. You know, at the state level where I mostly work, it's impossible to compare the same kind of economic development incentive program from state to state, because the reporting such as it exists, although it's primitive, is also completely non-uniform. In many states, you can't even compare programs to each other within the same state. Auditors repeatedly find that commerce departments don't even track good enough data to allow meaningful judgments about cost effectiveness of single programs, much less compare programs meaningfully to each other. So this idea that some of the programs that are now being reported in a standardized way under recovery.gov involve commingling with state funds, and therefore states are going to get used to reporting it in a uniform way and could do it, continue to do it that way for the rest of their state expenditures for economic development, is extremely exciting to us Wongs.
And let me just add to that too. I mean, I think economics can oftentimes seem more like alchemy than, you know, a hard science. But at least with the valuation side here, there is a science here. There is established methodologies, and so you know, if the Treasury Department were to start ginning up some of these numbers and then opening their books about how they do it, that can be checked and double-checked, and so you can have a larger community really get a hand on whether they're doing these analytics correctly or not. Some of the other areas, it gets a little bit fuzzy, but we can rely on established methodologies in the vast majority of cases.
It's great. I didn't think we could get through a Sunshine Week event without the word crowdsourcing. So I'm going to add that to your comment that you get lots of voices. Last question, and then we need to take a break and move on.
My name is Pat Clausen. I'm a former investigative reporter for NBC and CNN. I'm now a private investigator in Michigan. I specialize in financial issues. You know, as Rahm Emanuel said recently, you know, crises present interesting opportunities, and you can't really afford to waste a good crisis. Why aren't we moving now, the public interest community, why aren't we moving now to get rid of the exemption in the Freedom of Information Act that exempts financial institutions from disclosure? I mean, this is the perfect time to do it. This exemption has been repeatedly invoked over the years for no real valid reason, as far as I can see. 25 years ago, when I was a reporter running around Washington doing television investigations, I asked the FDIC under the FOIA for a set of their examination manuals on how they examined financial institutions. They wouldn't give me a set, citing the exemption, all right? I went into the FDIC, and I wandered around until I found a clerk who could point me to a closet, and I took a set for my own use. All right?
That was John Irons.
It could be. Thank you very much for the help, by the way.
I've never been at the FDIC. Let me just make that very clear.
But those manuals are now actually available on the Internet 25 years later, and I don't see that the Republic has collapsed because that information has become out. So why aren't we starting now to organize a dialogue about getting the FOIA Act amended to get rid of this exemption? Because I'm going to tell you right now, the taxpayers outside of the Beltway, they want to see it gone.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think Dan may be the best person to speak to that.
Although, I was just about to suggest that Senator Leahy might be willing to speak to that.
Yeah.
Because he's most directly involved in the amendment process. And if you guys write quickly enough right now, sure. We can then previous meetings about 10 minutes and have Senator Leahy in here.
Cool. With that, thank you.